the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. The first voice you heard was that of my wife, Sarita, singing with the incomparable Joe Pass Trio, Ella Fitzgerald's favorite jazz guitarist. And the second voice you heard was the incomparable Francis Sinatra. That was the night that he took over the Tonight Show as host, and I was lucky enough to be the first person he invited on the show, where I did a stand-up, and this is the voice of John Barber, I must tell you. It is really hot here. You know, the Bilderbergers, as you know, have been meeting in Europe, and protesters are all over the streets with signs telling them to go to hell. I would suggest they change that to Las Vegas. It is 110 degrees here. Somebody said it's so hot that Jehovah's Witnesses are sending emails. Anyway, if the weather won't fry your brain, how about this news today from the networks that'll fry your brain? And that is that Jeb Bush has officially announced that he's running for the presidency. Honestly, folks, I wish that both Jeb and Hillary were running from us. You know, that is so pathetic for this country. And, you know, I hate to say this, and I hate to sort of say it out loud, because for years and years on television, I've always been very quiet and reserved. And unless I was billed as a critic, or unless I was billed as somebody who was making a commentary, I would never talk like this. But I must tell you, Bush's and Clinton's for decades as choices to be in the White House, that is absolutely and totally pathetic. 320 million people, and we end up with this at the bottom of the barrel. Turn the barrel upside down so we can pretend we're scraping it from the top. I mean, a vote for the Bushes is like sailing on the Titanic, and then a vote for a Clinton is like flying the Hindenburg, for crying out loud. You know, the most pathetic and most dangerous people I've ever met, and I've met a lot of them in this business, are those with full bank accounts and empty lives. You know, the ultra-rich do not have representatives in government like us, like congressmen and senators. The rich call them employees. And I sent an open letter to one of them whose company has become a total pest to me. And that's an open note to Mark Zuckerberg. I said, "Dear Mr. Zuckerberg, it's bad enough that your Facebook enterprise keeps reposting ads that I've previously deleted four or five times, but now it's forcing me to listen to iTunes radio stations that I didn't even know existed, but that some phantom expert on your payroll informs me are stations that I like. Please desist from doing this, and if you continue, please send me the ones in my native language, English, not Spanish, plus," and I'm sure a lot of you had this happen to you, "please stop sending me suggestions for friends, especially one for Fletcher Prouty, who's been dead for years." not only are corporations losing touch with us, but the government's losing touch with their voters. I mean, absolute and total proof, our government is monumentally inept. Over the years, they declared a war on drugs and lost. They declared a war on poverty and lost. They declared a war on illiteracy and lost. They declared war on a dirty environment and lost. They declared wars in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Salvador, and Cuba, and lost. They declared war on non-existent terrorists, and we, the people, are now losing more of our liberties. Now, maybe they'll listen to John Lennon, whom they probably offed, and give peace a chance. You know, they say the good die young. I say if they're in politics, they've probably been murdered. And now, a voice I've wanted to listen to for a long time, a terrific writer and researcher who knows as well as anyone how the murdered got that way. Now, for those of you who love true crime and conspiracy stories, especially those that change your country and your life, a must, well-written, well-researched book for you and your library is Hidden History. From the murder of JFK to the Boston Marathon, it is a virtual chronological Wikipedia of governmental wickedness with some eye-opening crimes you've never heard of, but all of which you'll never forget. The voice, the author, Donald Jeffries. Donald, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for finally being here.
Well, thank you for having me, John.
Well, I guess after reading your book, which I absolutely loved, I got to say that you sort of disproved how inept the government is, because when it comes to crimes and keeping secrets, the government is not inept. Now, this is a question that I've thought about for a long time, and I've never posed it to anyone. Never really had the opportunity, so I'll pose it to you, and perhaps you've thought about it too. The two major crimes committed somehow by our government in my lifetime have been 9/11 and the assassination of John Kennedy. In your mind and in your heart, which do you think was the most damaging to us and to the world and to our psyche?
Boy, that's a tough question. I think for my generation, I was born in 56, the Kennedy assassination was the seminal event. I think it paved the way for everything else that happened in the 1960s. I think unquestionably, not just the Vietnam War, but I think everything was altered because of it. I think psychologically it had a huge impact on Americans, especially since that was really the first event that was covered so widely by television like that. I mean, that's my first memory as a seven-year-old was just watching that nonstop funeral procession and mourners going to the casket. And, you know, I didn't realize at the time, being 7 years old, that how little investigative reporting was being done, too. And that kind of set the standard, too, is because, as I point out in my book, NBC News early on agreed officially in writing that they would only broadcast stories that were consonant with the FBI's findings. So this is one of the three major networks at the time. We didn't have all the the stations that we have now agreeing to do that. So I think it had a huge impact on the country, young people that had joined the Peace Corps and so forth, the idealist. 9/11, I think probably by the time that came along, we had already, you know, started losing a lot of our personal freedom and liberties, I think. But certainly it's been accelerated since 9/11. I mean, the war on, you know, I don't know about the war on terror, but the war on civil liberty certainly began in earnest after 9/11. I mean, we've just lost so much. And, you know, you try to tell people, and it happens gradually, so they just don't realize it. But I would imagine the young people, my children, and, you know, people of that generation, the millennials, or whatever you call them, that 9/11 is their Kennedy assassination. So which one was more devastating? I personally, for me, the Kennedy assassination is, you know, what has grabbed me and obsessed me since the 70s. But again, I'm a baby boomer, so that kind of stands to reason.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. I think it's a seminal moment. And they were so successful at it, they were able to continue it in the same forces, probably ended up being involved somehow in 911. You said you watched it when you were 7 years of age. Did you watch it with your family? Do you remember any of your family's comments or reactions to it?
Oh, yeah. We were a Catholic family, and so they all loved Kennedy. And, you know, that it was particularly devastating, I guess, because it was the first Catholic president, and so they felt a connection to him. And, my dad especially was very political, and, nobody especially, they all hated Johnson, you know. And so there was a lot of speculation, even as a kid, that I got that Johnson was behind it somehow. So even as a child, I kind of grasped that. And his behavior, even to a little kid, he seemed to be acting, you know, as if he was in grief or something. Even as a little kid, I could kind of determine that just seeing him on television. And later, as you know, you investigate it more, you realize.
That is such a terrific observation, you know, that you said he was acting out his grief. I was around, I think I was 30 when it happened, and I had been working at the Hungry Eye. And I was there in early November, and I was booked back to open on the 23rd of November after it had happened. And so I had to write a whole new act, but I was glued to the television set, and then I saw Lyndon Johnson at night. And I thought not much about the assassination because, like Von Meter, who did this brilliant comedy album called The First Family, I thought, I may have lost the president, but my God, what's worth to me at the time was that I lost my act and my livelihood. So I paid close attention to what was going on. And there was Lyndon Johnson having to read about his grief rather than speaking it from the heart. You're the only other person I've ever heard even reference that. And that, while I was not interested in it at the time, that just raised such doubts in my mind about the man. Now, you're 7 years of age and you're growing up. Did you have any idea that this would be the path that you would follow in your life, which was doing this incredible research into these amazing stories? And I must repeat again, Hidden History is an absolutely must-have book for anybody who is interested in what has been happening to America. It's a wonderful book, Donald, again, and congratulations. But anyway, at that time, did you have any idea this was the path you were going to take?
Oh, thanks for the kind compliments again.
And taking that path.
Well, it's 7 years old. I don't know if you can see, into the future like that, but I was political from a very early age on. I followed politics very closely in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy was running. I felt that connection to the Kennedys, and though I didn't, at that age, I wasn't really thinking, well, there was a conspiracy. Although I never, even as a kid, it just always was in my mind that, you know, he died and it wasn't explained, and this Oswald guy I don't think could have done it, but I was sophisticated enough really to study it, and I didn't read the books on it until probably I read the first book on, it was They've Killed the President by Robert Sam Anson, and then I read Rush to Judgment by Mark Lane, but that was probably 74. So when I was a teenager, I really started getting into it, but when Bobby Kennedy was running for the president, I was really following his campaign. We were on the East Coast, and I was following the California primary. I was following the primaries, and I was crushed when he lost to McCarthy in Oregon. And even as a 12-year-old, and I remember waking up and, that morning yelling to my dad, "Hey, did Bobby Kennedy win the primary?" And yeah, but he was shot. And that really crushed me. It really impacted me. And I don't know whether at that age I was buying into the Kennedy curse thing, but again, I absorbed all that coverage with the trains going on and all the black and white people, kids, saluting him and holding flags and stuff, and Andy Williams on television singing Battle Hymn of the Republic. I mean, it was a very emotional experience for me, and so that one affected me more because I was older and I was getting to be a little bit politically aware. But once I first started reading the critical books, once I read Rush to Judgment and I started reading Harold Weisberg's books, Accessories After the Fact by Sylvia Marr, there was no turning back. I mean, you open these doors and just, And sooner or later, obviously, it led into other areas, as Hidden History shows. I mean, I began to be interested in all these things and sense that there were connections between them. But the Kennedy assassination it's pulled me forever. I mean, I read so many books on it that, you know, were just delved into the minutiae and just, you know, reveled in it sometimes, you know, like a lot of us do. But so whether I believed it, I don't know. But once I was a teenager, I realized that I probably was never going to turn my back on it.
Well, you said you opened that door, and the truth is, if you open that door and you're thoughtful, it sucks you through the door. And if you close the door and don't enter and look at it, you have the feeling that you're depriving yourself of somewhat of your life and somewhat of the truth. Now, you mentioned Mark Lane. I first met Mark in 1970 when I was doing the AM show in Los Angeles. And he had accompanied Jane Fonda, who was very outspoken against the Vietnam War, and I put her on the show. And then when Mark wrote Rust to Judgment, I interviewed Mark. How did you end up becoming associated with Mark?
Well, I mean, it was a brief association, and it certainly was, exciting for me as a teenager. I was probably 17, 18 years old, and he was just forming his groups around the country called the Citizens Committee of Inquiry, and we were trying to lobby Congress and the media to try to, you know, get a new investigation started in Congress, which, of course, a year or two later became the House Assassinations Committee, which, you know, we were all disillusioned by. But as I stated in the book, I had that one memorable time when I met him and spent most of the day in his office, and he got a phone call from Freddie Prinz in Hollywood, and he just it all came out. He just related how obsessed Freddie Prinz was with the assassination, and you know, at that time, Freddie Prinz was a huge star, you know, and he wasn't that much older than me. I think he was 21, 22 or something, but he was one of the biggest young names in show business, and if I hadn't been there that day, I would have never thought he had any connection at all with the Kennedy assassination, because he supposedly killed himself a few months later, and there was no mention of the Kennedy assassination when they had a made-for-TV movie about it. Maybe a year or so later, or less than that, there was no mention at all of his last days. So, and I just thought that really had a huge impact on me, too, because I had a personal stake there, because I had been there. I know that he was interested in it, obsessed with it.
You know, when Freddie Prinze shot himself, he was viewing the Zapruder film.
I didn't know that. I know Mark Lane said he had his own copy, and he was looking at it all the time. Wow, where did you hear that?
The very last show Freddie ever did was a show that I had. I had a live show at 8 o'clock. Aside from being the film critic at large on NBC with Tom Snyder in Los Angeles, I had another half-hour live show 5 nights a week. And the very last show that Freddie did was my show. And I'll tell you something really weird. I don't know that I believe in this kind of stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard of anybody who's truly psychic. I met one person who was Peter Hurkos, very famous psychic, who predicted some things that did come true. My wife embraced her father the last time we saw him, and she started crying. She told me later she'd never see him alive because she felt dead, and he had a heart attack and died. When Freddie Prinze left our show and he hugged my wife started to whimper and said, "There's something wrong with Freddie." And then he had just signed a $2 or $3 million contract with NBC for Chico and the Man, mm-hmm. and then he shot himself while watching the Zapruder film. So you and I have a lot of things in common. So let's move now. You're a little older, and it's the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Or put that on pause a second. I have one brief Mark Lane story to tell. Mark Lane was a very important contributor to my documentary, The Garrison Tapes, and he wrote a wonderful book called Plausible Denial. And I paid Mark $5,000 to option it as a play. Do you remember a play called Inherit the Wind?
Yeah, sure, a long time. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful play. Well, I thought that Plausible Denial would be a fantastic court drama, so I gave him $5,000 and optioned it. I was to write it with him, and we were going to write it together, and once the thing was done, I was going to direct it. Well, as we worked, the play got better and better, and Mark got the idea that instead of my directing it, he was going to call in Jules Dassin, a blacklisted writer. And I admire Jules Dassin's work. He did a great film called He Who Must Die, the Kasanzaki novel. Brilliant, but blacklisted. And I said, no, Mark, our agreement was that I directed, and it didn't work out. And we parted company. I think Mark's book, Rush to Judgment, is the foundation for all of this. So I have great admiration for him. But I must tell you, from all the people that I've been in touch with who run these assassination sites or who are major contributors and doing monumental research in this case, the egos of these people are as much a hindrance to finding the truth about this as is the federal government.
We could talk about that the whole hour, boy. If you, I mean, I've been so involved in these forums online, and that's been the most disillusioning thing to me is meeting so many people, Josiah Thompson, David Liston. I mean, these people that are online anyhow. And it's amazing. You're right about that. Mark Lane has had very little contact online as far as the forums. But, yeah, the battles on there, I've said over and over again, I used to try to be the kumbaya guy on these forums. I would always get on there, can't we all get along? Can't we, you know? And they just won't do it. They want to argue. They all want to. You saw that when Oliver Stone's JFK came out, that they were all mad that he picked Garrison. They all wanted to be the protagonist. I mean, he had to come up with the protagonist somehow. They all wanted to do that. Weisberg wanted it. Lane wanted it. And, you know, I don't know who else wanted it, but I know they did.
You mentioned Harold Weisberg. I have nearly every one of his self-published books, and they are absolutely brilliant. They're wonderfully written, and they're mostly absolutely right on. But the inside story is that Weisberg was so upset at Oliver that he's the one that bootlegged the copy of the script even before they opened a frame of film and sent it to the CIA critic asset at the Washington Post, who published a front page attack on Oliver.
Certainly. George Lardner Jr. He was the one that leaked it, and he was outspoken. I mean, I met Harold Weisberg one time. Again, as a young admirer, he lived in Frederick, Maryland, which wasn't too far from me. And he used to trudge into court every day, a very heroic figure, to do those, go and fight in court for the Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, to, arrest these documents from the FBI or whatever. And so he didn't drive at that point. He was already elderly. And I picked him up and rode him back to his house in Frederick. And he asked me in. I had dinner with him and his wife. And but it was, you talk about a grumpy old man. I mean, he was a grumpy old man. I mean, he was drinking little bottles of liquor in my car, little portable travel bottles of liquor, and he was just bad-mouthing everybody. And I had heard about that when I was in Mark Lane's group. I heard that there was a special rivalry between those two. But I think most of the hostility was on Weisberg's side. But he didn't like anybody, and I think he did have a chip on his shoulder because his work, as you mentioned, was brilliant. He did a lot of important stuff. They were always my favorite books, even though he had kind of a crotchety writing style, which matched his personality. It rubbed some people the wrong way, but he was just brilliant. I mean, if you can get through Postmortem, I mean, that's incredible work on the medical evidence, and photographic whitewash is great about the pictures. I mean,
yes. Well, I spoke for the first time. A number of people over the years have written on my behalf to a number of these assassination sites since I modestly have to say that when Jim Garrison lost his Clay Shaw trial, he didn't speak to anyone for 10 years until he sat down for 3.5 hours with me and gave me all his stuff and told this amazing story. And after Oliver did his film, I had the opportunity to personally raise some money and do this documentary, and
that was a great work, boy. I loved your documentary.
Oh well, thank you so much. Anyway, I got sidetracked a bit, and I didn't mean to get sidetracked. Let's get to the business of Bobby Kennedy, which was probably the most heartbreaking event for you since you were now a teenager.
Well, I was 12 when he died. I mean, I was still a kid, but I was politically aware, and I was rooting hard for him, and it really crushed me. And it really didn't. again, I didn't, and actually, I probably became aware before I read the first Kennedy, the JFK book. I was watching, as you mentioned, Tom Snyder. He used to have some good shows, but he would have these guys on quite a bit. And he had Allard Lowenstein on when he was a congressman, and who, of course, later was assassinated himself, you know, in this wild world they have where these people just tend to die this way. But anyhow, he was on there talking about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, and I was instantly fascinated. So I was probably even younger then. I might have been 16, but I really latched onto that. But it was actually a little bit after that that I started reading about the JFK assassination and just took off with that. But I instantly realized something was, you know, was wrong there with the RFK assassination when I heard him, you know, just go over the basic evidence. You know, the shot had to come from behind, the powder burns on the behind the ear that, you know, Noguchi talked about, and Sirhan was never, you know, that close to him and was always in front of him, according to all the witnesses. So it's an easy thing to see the girl in the polka dot dress. I mean, I go over all that in my book, but it's the same kind of stuff we see in the JFK assassination. But it's just amazing to have this kind of information. I know you know that, and just to turn on, I turned on C-SPAN the other day. They had a thing about the JFK assassination. just so predictable. They had this, I can't remember the professor's name now. I think he's local to me. He might be Georgetown or George Washington or something, university. But just getting up there and pontificating, holding up Reclaiming History by Bugliosi and say, this is the one book I would recommend on the assassination. And he didn't know anything. You know, he was trying to talk about maybe a bullet. You know, he was talking about when JFK went, you know, under the Stemmons Freeway sign. And of course, he didn't know the name of the sign even. But he had so limited knowledge of it. And the questions from the audience, it wasn't a single, you know, probing question. It might as well have been a press conference, a presidential press conference. And I said,
You point out a really interesting observable fact about this professor's know-nothing telling of the assassination when you talk about the fact that Tom had Allard Lowenstein on. And, of course, the Zapruder film was made public when Geraldo Rivera had Robert Groden and Dick Gregory on late night. And that's actually what the public furor over seeing that film and realizing that Dan Rather had lied to them about the head being tossed violently forward is what resulted in the, like, 3 million pieces of mail going to Congress, so they have to set up the House Select Committee. But years ago, on every anniversary, there'd be one or two programs that would sort of put a question mark on this. But this last, a year ago, when it was the 50th anniversary, yeah, there was not one dissenting voice about the assassination of John Kennedy. And Tom Brokaw was the one who had brought me to KNBC, and we had occasional contact over the years, and I called him. And I knew he was doing something on the military channel, and I said, Tom, just give me 5 minutes for Jim Garrison to say something about this. And he said, no. So those voices are never heard again. And as for Noguchi was being pilloried by the LAPD, who was infested with CIA, and by the LA City Council, because he would not change, as you pointed out, his autopsy report, showing that the gun could not have been more than 2.5 inches from the left rear because of the extensive powder burns, and they tried to get rid of him. So myself and his attorney founded a committee, the co-chair, the committee to save Thomas Noguchi as an independent coroner for the county of and city of Los Angeles. And the person opposing it the most was my friend Sinatra. And we were about to do a show together, his autobiography on video. And Noguchi lost and I lost. Lost a great job and a great friendship. But and then I was so pleased, that may not even be the right word, that you did such an admirable job even going into the death of John Kennedy Jr. And I was surprised and impressed by the research you did on that in your book, Hidden History.
Well, yeah, I thank you. I I think that probably is one of the highlights of the book for people, because it's something that you're not going to find anywhere else. And I had my doubts. By the time he was killed in 1999, in my 40s, so I was 43. So I was clearly had been involved in researching this stuff for a long time. So when I first heard his plane was missing, I realized they weren't going to find him alive. The odds are, you just kind of know these things. And I was aware of how, frightening he must be as a potential candidate to the establishment, because, that's what if you notice the thread in my book, I talk about all these Kennedys, and I think that, the blood is thicker than water thing, going back to Shakespeare, it's real with these people, and I think they realize it. And as I point out in my book, I know from a couple people who, they didn't want to be identified, but they were inside John F. Kennedy Jr.'s circle. It was close to them. That he was very interested in his father's assassination, and one of them even said he had a quest to find out who killed him. And that's something I hadn't known before, and went a long way to explaining his death. And I point out in the book that Wayne Madsen, an investigative reporter, told me and verified in an email that he was set to meet with John F. Kennedy Jr. the week after he died. That was when he was scheduled to meet, to begin a job at George Magazine, and his main assignment was to research the assassination of his father, President Kennedy. So he wasn't just a pretty boy. That was he had some real political ideas, and he was frightening to them, because there's nothing more frightening than the heir to the heir apparent that wants to, because that's a huge motivation there. It's not with me or somebody. I'm mad that they got away with killing a president or whatever, but when it's your father, then you have such a personal stake there. And I think we even saw that with Caroline Kennedy, where they really sabotaged her, looked like a shoo-in to be named to the Senate. And at the last minute, they just pulled the rug out from under her, and with this ridiculous article saying Caroline Kennedy said, 100 and some times or something. I mean, people say that all the time. They clean the grammar up for these celebrities that aren't exactly articulate sometimes, but I think even someone as seemingly as non-threatening as Caroline Kennedy, who looks like she's played the game well, doesn't talk about any of those issues, smiles, very private, but the fact she was JFK's daughter was too much, I think, at the end for someone to handle, and they said, nope, she can't be in the Senate.
I'm going to take a break, but I'm going to ask you a question now to think about, so when we come back after the break. The question is this. They obviously did sabotage Carolyn, but why is it that Robert Kennedy Jr. and Kathleen Kennedy have absolutely nothing to say or contribute about the murder of either Robert or John, and they assiduously avoid it, even though Robert Kennedy Jr., in an interview with Charlie Rose a year and a half ago in Dallas, offhandedly said that his father did not believe the conclusions of the Warren Report. We're going to take a brief break right now. We're going to be back with the incomparable Donald Jeffries and more about hidden history. We'll be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
I'd like to thank George Knack, the very best host on Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon, as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some from some very famous people. Also, while you're there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook, Volume 1, with a terrific intro by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place, honestly, and find something that'll make you laugh or think or make you angry. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. I want to welcome back now Donald Jeffries. Great book, Hidden History. Put it in your library. It's a must, easy read. Okay, Don, the question was about Robert and Kathleen. Why? Do you think they are frightened for their families? Or because I go back to what Jim Garrison said right after Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and he told those who knew Bobby Kennedy, tell him to go public, it will save his life. Yeah. And after Bobby was shot, he said if he'd gone public, he'd still be alive. And the same might be hold true for John Kennedy Jr. If he had gone more public rather than just his inner circle, he might too be alive. And if they had killed him, which they probably did, there would have been a massive public reaction and outrage to that.
No, I agree with you. Their strategy, if it's for self-preservation, hasn't worked very well because they keep dying unnaturally, unfortunately. And so it hasn't worked if that was their goal. But yeah, as far as Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I think of all the Kennedys, I hold out the most hope for him because he's shown signs. He's spoken out about vote fraud. He's spoken out about the link between vaccines and autism and other disorders. And he did, speak fondly of James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable. So he has, and as you mentioned, the Charlie Rose interview, which we still yet to see. I'd still like to see a video of that, but I don't know where he's keeping it.
I'll tell you the reason you don't see it. Bobby Kennedy doesn't want it seen. I'll tell you a very quick story that you may have heard of before, but during the 50th anniversary, I had offered everyone, the last word, the Garrison tapes free to air. Any network, any cable station, PBS, everybody, they should see and hear Garrison's story. Everyone turned it down. So I figured the only way I could get attention to it is set up a screening at UNLV and have Bobby Kennedy, because I'd heard about it talking to Charlie Rose, and pay him to come out here. George Knapp had agreed to interview him for nothing because it was in the public interest. Mm-hmm. I had to negotiate 6 months through Dick Russell, who is a very dear friend of mine, and he's a writing partner of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s, okay? Mm-hmm. I spoke to their agency, the Kepler Agency in Virginia. One time he and Kathleen, or Carolyn, had been paid $150,000 to appear at a private function for a company to talk about the assassination, which they did. Dick told me that Bobby Jr. needed money. How can any Kennedy need money? So I agreed to take my last $25,000 and pay him. He accepted it. We were scheduled for December 12th at UNLV. 1,200 people were waiting to see the interview between George Knapp and Bobby Kennedy, and he was going to introduce the Garrison tapes. And he backed out at the last minute. And I told Dick, I said, you know, if there's ever a sequel to Profiles in Courage, it will never have a chapter about Bobby Kennedy Jr. I've done more to look into his father's death Then he asked, for crying out loud, "Well, I did not want to waste the money, so I hired Joan Mellon and Dick Russell and Jim Mars to come out to UNLV. And frankly, I must say, had Bobby done it, the emotional impact would have sold enough DVDs so I could do the much-needed part two, because I have astonishing stuff still from Garrison. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, he has nothing to contribute. But Joan Mellon and Dick Russell and Jim Mars, like you, have enormous stuff to contribute, and I am prouder of that than if Bobby had shown up. Anyway, that's my diatribe against Bobby Kennedy Jr. But
well, I know Bobby. The Bobby Kennedy Jr. has my book because I got an address for him through one of those anonymous sources, and we Skyhorse sent it to him. Now, so of course my fantasy is he'll like it and do enough. But knowing what you've just told me, I guess that's kind of a pipe dream. But I've tried to hook up with a lot of the Kennedys are on social media. You probably see them on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. And I'm hooked up with a lot of them. And it's not because I'm being a Kennedy fanboy, but because my avatar in all these places is the cover of Hidden History, I'm hoping that it'll click to maybe one of the younger ones, you know, and maybe they'll want to, you know, have an interest because, as you mentioned, the emotional impact of a Kennedy. I mean, imagine Carolyn Kennedy, you know, but then, you know, maybe we're overestimating that because, you know, you had Coretta Scott King and Dexter King working openly to try to get James Earl Ray a new trial, and it didn't seem to matter to the media, mainstream media.
And speaking of that, you have a terrific section in your book about the King trial. And again, it was like Mark Lane in Plausible Denial. He won that case in Florida, and nobody ever heard about it. And Mark had to write the book. And now you have Coretta King and her family winning a civil case against both the FBI and the federal government, a jury finding them guilty and complicit in the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And nobody hears about it.
Yeah, well, if there's an underlying theme to my book, someone once said, I think that in Hidden History, it's the overriding theme, I think, is the failure of the mainstream media. Because if we just had one big television network that was honest and actually hired, you know, Lois Lane-type reporters, real reporters that actually wanted to investigate, and that's why you see things like Boston Bombing and Sandy Hook and things like that. Why you see these kids that are living in their parents' basements, they investigate these things. They put out professional videos that are better than you see anywhere on CNN or Fox News, and they ask the questions that these reporters, I don't know if they're just trained not to ask the questions or it's been the curiosity's been educated out of them, but they have no inquisitiveness. The only skepticism they ever have are directed at people like us. People that are asking the questions, they'll investigate us. What's the matter with you? But they won't investigate the officials.
That's such an astute observation. I have a dear friend in California. His name's Joe Satilli. He used to work for PBS in Washington, and he was doing a documentary about depleted uranium that the Pentagon didn't want aired, so they didn't air it, and Joe lost his job. And I said to him, but what? Joe, there are no more investigative reporters, no more great journalists. And he said, now bless his heart, because he's struggling. He does a great a newsletter called News Vandal. And he said, John, but there are better investigative journalists. They're better, but they're on social media. They're on the internet. They are not on the networks. And what you said is so true, because you find some absolutely brilliant stuff on the internet.
Incredible.
I mean, you have to wade through maybe 90% of it, but boy, there's a pony under that horseshit somewhere, you know.
Oh yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I'm fascinated by that. I mean, I go to a lot of these conspiracy forums, and the more extreme the better for me. You know, I try to keep the most open mind possible. But
anyway, there's somebody calling in. I don't know who he is or where he's from, but my producer tells me somebody wants to ask you a question. And
sure,
quite often the best questions come from the listeners. Listener, are you there? Line two.
Yes.
Mary, welcome to the show. You have a question for Donald.
Yes, hello.
Hello to you.
To ask, Hi. I wanted to ask Donald, you know, I really wanted to talk about 9/11, but if we could spring forward 14 years, and let's talk about Jade Helm. So, Donald, do you think that we are seeing another false flag unfold, or could it get more serious? To what degree do you think that this could go south on us?
Well, you know, the Jade Helm thing is, it's one of those events that happens. I know Alex Jones has made a lot out of it and had a lot of live coverage in Texas there, but it's one of those things that we get all the time where it looks like this is the big one. This is the big thing where they're finally going to come out of the woodwork and stop pretending that, you know, they're good guys and, you know, they're just going to really clamp down openly, but then it kind of faded away. So I'm not sure Jade Helm was the kind of doom scenario that a lot of the conspiracy people are waiting for. And something like that may or may not happen, but
you know how it impresses me, and I'm like Donald. I like to see a lot of skullduggery in a lot of what the government does, but it sounds to me and looks to me a little about the panic furor that we heard at the change of the millennium when 2000 ended and 2001 was about to begin. And we were warned that all our computers would crash and the grid would crash and everything would fall apart. And absolutely nothing happened. And it may just be what the government says it is. It's just some kind of military operation, and they're running it in this country because, you know, we need probably more tanks in this country than we have in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think much will happen with it personally.
I think, again, we're so used to these things that what we see every day, I mean, whether you're looking at, you know, the online videos of police, just, you know, police brutality, it's every single day all across the country. You get new examples of it. And, you know, what we saw after the Boston bombing where they declared martial law in a major American city. We had tanks rolling through the city, armed raids and, on people's houses, ordering people out of the houses. And nobody rebelled at that. And so I think at this point, we've become so submissive and we're so used to this. Is what I call my latest blog entry. I talk about the authoritarianism that we have now. We're just living under, especially if you compare things to back in the 1970s, 1980s even, we have so much less personal freedom than we had then. And we just take it for granted that, you know, that unconstitutional roadblocks everywhere, the click-it-or-ticket stuff, you know, you can't smoke cigarettes anywhere.
Back in the 70s and 80s, words even had a different meaning. I mean, if you used the word cop killer in the 70s, you were talking about some civilian who killed cops. Now you're talking about cops themselves are cop killers. It's shocking. Anyway, of all the conspiracies that you've investigated and you do in your book, Hidden History, is there one that startled you the most or shocked you the most or surprised you the most?
Well, probably the most personally reprehensible were the Franklin scandal and all the child sex scandals. I mean, that's probably the hardest to understand aspect of the elite people that rule us, is that they undeniably seem to have a predilection for having sex with children. And, you know, maybe we can't understand that, but it's clearly there because it comes up over and over again. And you know, Alex Jones likes to say that they you know, so many of these politicians, end up either, you know, the gay bashers end up being gay themselves, or they are pedophiles or something, as we saw with Dennis Hastert and the wrestling when he was a high school wrestling coach. That maybe these people are elevated because of the fact they are so blackmailable. If they get out of line, then, you know, they have these things to hold over their head, which they, you know, hopefully there are not that many pedophiles that are running around, so they wouldn't have that to hold over their head.
I was astonished and pleased to see that toward the end of the book you had this, speaking of what you're just talking about, the McMartin preschool case, because I was in Los Angeles at the time all of that was erupting. Could you go into that just a little bit?
Yeah, that's amazing how the press, you know, just kind of acted as if that it was disproven that these kids were all lying. I mean, why would all the kids make up all the same kind of outlandish stories? Apparently, they did find these tunnels underneath there later that they said were there. And most importantly, as I point out in the book, the medical exams they did on these children showed that, like, an overwhelming majority of them had, you know, rectal and vaginal indications that they had been, you know, sexually abused. I don't know what better evidence you can have than that. I mean, my kids went to preschool, and I don't think anything like that was going on, but I would have been really concerned if even one child had that going, you know. But I really don't, as I put in there, I actually emailed one of the leading people that was involved in that, Jackie McGauley, and I really was, you know, her emails to me had a strange ring. I really don't know what was going on there, because she wrote some nice online articles about talking about the tunnels were actually there, but she kind of backed off in the emails to me, like she didn't. I have, you know, I put the excerpts in the book, and I'm not sure what was going on there, but you have a lot of strange connections there. You have, you know, one of the Righteous Brothers, Bill Medley, his, as I put in there, his first wife, I believe. They have a little connection there to the McMartin preschool, and I actually tried getting in contact with him, and his manager said he had no, you know, more comment on it. But it's a huge thing, and certainly, you know, if something like that.
Speaking of your family, are they nervous about what it is that you do and what it is you talk about and write about in public? Have you lost any friends over what it is that you're doing?
Well, you know, people that know me have heard me rant and rave about these things for decades, so it's not really new to them. Maybe they're amazed that somebody published me, but no, I don't think I've lost any friends too much, but my family, I think, yeah, is a little concerned sometimes. But as I've said, you know, if we have to fear writing a book, and some of them, it just shows the extent of how much we've lost. And you know, I mean, I get paranoid. Recently, a couple of writers, I don't know if you heard about it, Dave McGowan, who wrote Laurel Canyon, you know, weird scenes,
yes,
inside the canyon. You must have heard about that, Laurel Ridge.
Yes, yes.
Great guy. I mean, I've emailed him a couple times, and you know, I had just heard an interview with him, and then, you know, on Facebook, suddenly he was found to be gravely ill with cancer, and it looks like he's battling back a little bit. But at the same time, Nick Bryant, who wrote the introduction to him and had wrote a Franklin scandal book of his own, and I saw him interviewed recently. He apparently has severe, you know, I don't know how bad the cancer is, but it was in the Mayo Clinic the last I heard. So, you know, these are writers like me. So, yeah, it does kind of give you pause for thought. And I'm already paranoid enough.
A couple of things that I was delighted about was some of the trivia that I discovered in the book, that it might have been Bill Clinton who drove Paul Wellstone to the airport where he got on the plane, and then the plane disappeared and killed him. But there is a book to be written. You know the name My Brussel, obviously.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Have you ever seen her hour video on the Manson murders?
I believe I saw it a long time. Yeah, that's a story, the Manson story.
Well, I must tell you, you would be the perfect person to research and really write that story. I mean, the facts that she seems to uncover, in which she points out that Charlie Manson was not responsible. The Manson murders are so much a part of this culture as Jack the Ripper is in England. Yeah. But My Brussel says that it was a black op operation set up by the government to put an end to the flower children generation, which was revolutionizing young people in the 60s. And after the Sharon Tate slaughter, the flower children absolutely ceased to exist. Do you think there's any credence in that?
The Manson case is certainly fascinating, and Charles Manson certainly was the poster boy. He was, if you had to invent a demon hippie, you know, to scare Middle America with, boy, especially the photo they used of him all the time, the most crazy, and you know, certainly he plays the part well. But I've always just trying to point out to people that Charles Manson himself wasn't, you know, didn't kill anyone. I mean, you had Vincent Bugliosi's you know, conspiracy theory, and it's funny, he hates conspiracies, but he came up with one of his own with the Helter Skelter thing, you know, that the Beatles' White Album caused him to, it somehow caused him to be able to control all these hippies, and, you know, they went out, you know, and really, if you want to have someone who should have the reputation, it should have been Tex Watson and Susan Atkins. They're the ones
exactly.
who were the leaders and did the actual killing. But
the impact that it has, the impact that my Brussels interview has, is so startling. It had the same emotional impact to me, which was sort of frightening, as did Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? We only have about a minute, but you got any brief thoughts on Dr. Wood's work?
I'm somewhat familiar with her work, and I think that, you know, 9/11, again, kind of like the JFK assassination, which led to threads about, you know, was the Zapruder film altered and that kind of stuff. As Mark Lane said in Rush of Judgment, you know, because these crimes are not investigated, it provides fertile grounds for speculation, and that's what's going to happen in something like that. And when you come up with theories like that, unfortunately, the mainstream, even the mainstream conspiracy people, are just going to kind of, you know, roll their eyes and say that's crazy. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's crazy, but what I try to stress with 9/11 is the official conspiracy theory is impossible. You know, crazed 19 Arab hijackers taking over planes with plastic knives and box cutters. I mean, that just, while the entire country stood down for, you know, for over an hour and did absolutely nothing while planes were heading for the heart of the defense establishment.
Within 24 hours of that happening, Hunter Thompson was on radio in Australia saying it was an inside job. You can Google that if you're a Hunter Thompson fan. Donald, I'm going to tell you, I really, really enjoy your book. And again, I would suggest everybody get it. I would also suggest if you're interested in 911, you could Google Hunter Thompson talking in Australia. Or if you're interested in black op operations of the government, go to my Brussels site. She has hours of great material. But most of all, get Donald Jeffries' excellent, excellent book, Hidden History. Again, Don, thank you so much for being here, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed it, too.
Have a wonderful night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.